Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for the program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Dr. John Taylor. He's professor of economics at Stanford University, George P. Schultz Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of the new book, First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. His academic fields of expertise are macroeconomics, monetary economics, and international economics. He's known for his research on the foundations of modern monetary theory and policy, which has been applied by central banks and financial market analysts around the world. In fact, he's author of the Taylor Rule, which is a predictable procedure for setting interest rates, which are used by many central banks. He served as a senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors for Ford and Carter in that time period, the first Bush and second Bush, and has also served on the California Governor's Council of Economic Advisors under Pete Wilson and our past Governor Arnold. For 4 years, from 2001 into 2005, he served as Undersecretary of Treasury for International Affairs, where he was responsible for currency markets, trade and financial services, foreign investment, international debt, and development and oversight of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. He also helped to set up the financial system in Iraq. He has written five books, one on international finance, one of the first books on the financial crisis, two more books on preventing future crisis, and now his latest book on restoring America's prosperity, and the winner of the 2012 Hayek Prize. And John's also won numerous awards, and I think the one he probably would say he's most proud of is the one that he received for being the best teacher of undergraduate economics at Stanford. And that's voted on by the students, so that's a great one. He is a held positions of economics at Princeton University and Columbia University. He received his BA in economics summa cum laude from Princeton University and a PhD in economics from Stanford University. So please welcome John Taylor, and I really look forward to hearing his message tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Evelyn, for that kind introduction. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me, and thanks to all of you for coming. I really appreciate it. I'm going to start off on a little pessimistic note. Maybe you think that's what you expect economists to do, but quite frankly, I'm kind of a more optimist, and so I'm going to promise to you that I'm going to end on a more optimistic note. The election's now over, several months. The cliff discussion is now over several months. The inaugural address, State of the Union, are over. But unfortunately, as I look at our economic problems, they're by no means over. In the inaugural address, President Obama said, and I quote, "The economic recovery has begun." He's right, of course, it has begun. In fact, it began almost 4 years ago, as economists define it, in the summer of 2009, because that's when that deep recession, the downward movement in our economy, actually ended. So since then, we've had growth, and that's what economists mean by recovery. We're growing. The problem is the growth has been extraordinarily, historically low compared to previous recoveries. Growth has averaged about 2%. And as I look back through history, which I've tried to do as an economist, I see, generally speaking, the deeper the downturn, the further unemployment goes up, the more rapid recoveries tend to be. So if you look at the classify financial crises and deep recessions in our country over many years, more than 100 years, you'll find that the average growth rate coming out of these deep recessions is about 6%. And this one's only been about, I'm sad to say, only 2%. And for that matter, it's kind of gotten weaker as we've got into it. In 2010, growth was 2.4%. In 2011, 2%. 2012, the latest reading is 1.5%. Of course, we hope it's going to be better this year, and I think it will be, but still very low by historical standards. Now, unfortunately, this low growth has had many implications for our country, and in particular, I think, for labor markets. Here we are in San Francisco, where the unemployment rate is approximately 6.7%, so we're relatively lucky. In the country as a whole, it's nearly 8%, 7.9%. In the state as a whole, it's 9.8%. If you went an hour and a half to the east, to the Central Valley, Fresno, Merced, et cetera, you'd see unemployment at 15%. If you went way down south, El Centro, 26, 27% unemployment. So this is serious. This is, in fact, I sometimes get frustrated that we have this silence, if you like, about this problem. We don't talk about it enough, and it worries me. But the reason, a big part of the reason, is this very slow economic growth. Now, unfortunately, even that 6.7% I mentioned for San Francisco is not very good. And let me give you an example based on experience I've had in Washington. Evelyn mentioned it goes back a long time. So I worked in the Ford administration. And at that time, we had times were not that good. And so in the Council of Economic Advisors, we decided because of demographic factors in our country that it probably wouldn't be that easy to achieve an unemployment rate of 4%, because 4% was what the goal was coming out of the 60s. I was there in the mid-70s. So we looked at the numbers, looked at the young people coming into the labor force, the baby boom, and said, well, we probably should recalculate what kind of normal unemployment is. So we said 4.9. Now, obviously, it sounds like we're pricing gasoline. We didn't want to actually say 5. But the truth is 4.9 is what we said, so raising it from 4 to 4.9. Alan Greenspan was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors then, and as a result had to go report this result to the Congress. And I was there with him, of course. The chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, which is the committee to which the Council of Economic Advisers reports, was Hubert Humphrey, one of the staunchest liberal Democrats we have had. He was outraged by what we were doing, 4 to 4.9%. Who do you think you are? He said, if you economists were doctors, and we had a plague or an epidemic in the country, where people's temperature rose because of the sickness, your solution would be to raise the definition of normal body temperature. And it's a sense of the outrage. Now, so we have 6.7 in San Francisco. It's okay? No, it's not okay by those kinds of terms, which it seems to me how we should be thinking of this. It's even worse in some sense. If you think about the last few years, and go back longer if you want, a lot of people have dropped out of the labor force. They haven't kept looking for work. Some, of course, drop out because they retire, but a lot of extra have dropped out. And when you put that in, the unemployment rate seems to be about 9.1%. So it's even higher than that. If you just focus on this recovery again, the fraction of the working age population that's actually working now is less than when the recovery began. And that's unheard of in terms of our history. So the slow growth also has other problems. It means that median incomes have been declining. It means there's not as much revenue to the government for purposes of government expenditures. It means poverty is still near record highs. There's a lot of other implications. And so I'm concerned, and that's why I'm starting on this pessimistic note, if you like. Now, there are reasons out there for the slow recovery. One I alluded to at the beginning, saying that, well, we had such a deep recession. What do you expect? The financial system was damaged. What do you expect? Well, it seems to me that's kind of an excuse, because looking back in our past, that's not what has happened. That's not what has happened. We have had faster growth. And economists will dispute this, to be sure. But I look at the numbers, it's pretty clear. Some people say it was housing. The housing slow. What do you expect in a slow housing market, expect a slow recovery? Well, the truth is, all recoveries have good sectors and bad sectors. In the 1980s recovery from a deep recession, unemployment got even higher then. Growth was 6% or so. Housing was stronger, but our foreign trade was terrible because the strong dollar reduced a lot of our exports. So that was weak then. And moreover, housing's picked up recently, and you haven't really seen too much of a change in the economy. So I don't think that's a factor. Some people say, oh, it's deleveraging. Everybody borrowed so much going into the crisis, so you have to stop borrowing. You have to save more to pay back your debt, and that extra saving means consumption is going to be lower, and therefore people aren't buying, and so the economy is weak. Well, doesn't seem to add up. If you look at savings rates, how much people save as a fraction of their income, it's actually quite low now compared to other expansions. The 1980s expansion savings rate was about 10%. Now it's about 3 or 4%. So as I look through all these possible explanations, and I have, I come to a different conclusion. I come to the conclusion that it's really economic policy that's the problem, a broad sense of economic policy, which is what I want to explain and really what the purpose of the book that Evelyn mentioned, First Principles, is all about. Now, I've been teaching economics for a long time. Evelyn said I even got some prizes for doing it, which is really makes it doubly worthwhile. And over the years, I've emphasized kind of these principles to students. And for the purpose of this book, I kind of try to wrap the principles up into five points. And I call them the points of economic freedom. And by the way, Stanford's motto is, let the winds of freedom blow. I don't know how many people, you know, it's written in Germany, it's in German, but let the winds of freedom blow. Sometimes I feel like, well, we've got to let the winds of economic freedom blow, if you know what I mean, and I hope you do in a few minutes. For me, economic freedom is a situation, a policy, a procedure where people get to choose what they buy, what they sell, where they work, how they help other people. But they do this in a context of really five things. One is a predictable government policy based on number two, the rule of law, a focus on markets, which is number three, which provides incentives, number four, and a well-defined, if you like limited, but I'd say well-defined role for government in this operation. Now, in many senses, I think these principles are what made America great from the start, because it characterizes many of the things that we emphasize in this country. I think it's why people came here, why people still come here, and it's really why the country has been great. But the truth is we tend to go back and forth and sometimes adhere to these principles more and sometimes adhere to them less, and that's just what I see in the numbers. So I've been doing government for quite a while, and as I see it, I see a few swings that help us understand the importance of this. The first swing was really, that I'll talk about, was away from these principles, and that was in the late 60s and 70s, the time I was working in Washington. We had a policy which was anything but predictable. In the monetary sphere, we had go-stop monetary policy, got inflation higher, the Fed stepped on the brakes, unemployment rose, and that began in the mid-60s and lasted into the 70s until unemployment, before it stopped going down, was 10.8%, and double-digit inflation. It was terrible. That's the kind of policy that was, if you like, unpredictable, very unrule-like. Fiscal policy, we kind of do the same kind of things in the 70s. We had, you know the term now, stimulus packages. President Ford had a stimulus package. He's a Republican. This is not a partisan point of view. I worked for him. We recommended, that based on economics, that would probably not have been a good idea. It was basically one-time payments sent to people to get them to spend more to get the economy going. He did it. It didn't work. At least it didn't work very well. We, on his economic advisors, wrote that it didn't work very well and warned people not to do this anymore. But it continued. It continued with President Carter and various kinds of stimulus packages. I can go on and on, but as you can probably tell, but we had wage and price controls. Talk about getting away from markets. President Nixon imposed wage and price controls on this country, and it was a disaster. It let the Fed screw up its policy. It led to an enormous amount of resource wastage, including unemployment eventually rising. So you can think of these principles and see what happened. And, of course, let's face it, the results were pretty bad, as I've indicated. Very, very low growth, a lot of instability, inflation picked up, and worst of all, unemployment picked up. Now, look at another period. In this period, maybe from the late 70s, Paul Volcker was appointed to the Fed in 1979. By President Carter, he did a much different kind of policy. He got rid of the stop-go. He made it much more predictable, much more rule-like, if you like. focused on mainly getting inflation down because he knew that's what you needed to do to get unemployment down and make a strong economy. And he rallied people to do that. You had a move away from the short-term stimulus packages and things. You just had a tax cut, President Reagan, tax reform, tax cut, basically. Didn't hear about stimulus packages, even though the economy was worse then. The notion of wage and price controls was far from people's thinking. And this lasted for a long time. There was a proposal by President Bush 41 for a stimulus package. It didn't pass the Congress. President Clinton, if you remember, came in with a stimulus package. It didn't pass the Congress. And so as a result, he moved towards more budget balance types of policies. There was also, I like to point out, the welfare reform legislation. That was really limiting the scope of the federal government, giving more say to the local and state governments. And so I can go on. Now, before I do go on, let's remind ourselves times are pretty good in this phase. We had a couple of long expansions. In fact, economists call this the Great Moderation. Unemployment came down through that period for the most part. We had growth eventually picked up. Productivity growth picked up by the mid-90s. It was, by all relative accounting in American history, a good period. I think it corresponds to the policy. Now we are, I think, have drifted away again. And it didn't begin 4 years ago. It began earlier. I don't know exactly when. I think of monetary policy a lot because I see the Fed held rates very low. That stimulated the housing boom in many respects and eventually caused a bust. Our housing policy led to a lot of extra risk-taking as well, led to that boom, eventually the bust. In 2008, in the George W. Bush administration, there was a stimulus package, the kind of things that I thought we learned not to do. Monetary policy, I've already mentioned, but it got very interventionist. And it still is very interventionist, and the idea of policies that are of short-run stimulus is still very much there. So as I look through this history, and I think there's empirical evidence, and economists debate it, of course, let's face it, but I look at it, it's pretty clear that there's something wrong with the policy. And to me, the sooner we get back onto a kind of policy, again, think of my principles, predictable, rules-based, more focus on markets, don't forget about incentives, and be sure that what you have the federal government doing, it's what the federal government should be doing. Doing all those things, it seems to me, will deal with these unemployment problems, deal with these growth problems faster than you may think. When you apply these principles to current events, it gets very difficult, and you can see the discussions going on in Washington. I began with some of those, and now we're down to the sequester and the debt limit increase and continuing resolution. Boy, if you think about an emphasis on tactics and zero emphasis on strategy, this is it. There hasn't been a budget submitted. There hasn't been a budget passed by the Senate in 4 years. This is not order. This is not fiscal policy order. Fiscal policy order, the president submits a budget, both houses produce a resolution, and they get together to figure out what to do. That's not where we are. So to me, first get back to regular order. In the meantime, there's a problem of spending, and that's related to the debt. It's one of those problems that these policies have led to. And so let me just delve into a little bit on the debt issue because it's so current, and the sequester, it's so current. And just describe how these principles would apply to that, I think. So a few numbers. In 2007, federal spending as a share of GDP was 19.7%. Federal spending as a share of GDP, 19.7%. That's a pretty good way to measure the size of spending as relative to our total economy size. In the next few years, it rose dramatically to about 25%, maybe down to 24%, and now it's projected to, in the most recent CBO reports, to be about 23% as it goes out into the next 10 years. That's what they're talking about. So roughly from 19.7 to 23. To me, if you just thought about a household which was borrowing too much, or you sat down with a counselor because you were borrowing too much, and you recognize that you are spending much more as a fraction of your income, if you like, than before? Wouldn't the answer be to get your spending down to where it was before the mess started? I think it would be on my list. That's what you need to do. Take spending back as a share of GDP, which means more spending, to roughly where it was before all this began in 2007. And that's really what the debate is about. Put this in context. The sequester for this fiscal year, 2013, would reduce spending as a share of GDP by 0.26%. 0.26%. Compare that to the roughly 4 or 5% numbers I've been talking about. And that's what's bringing about the screams. It should make you worry a little bit. Now, there are legitimate aspects of screaming because part of that 0.26 is kind of across the board. And that means a particular government agency is just going to have to do it for all the different parts. And that's not the best way to do things in all cases. But if we just gave them the flexibility to get that 0.26, whether it's defense or non-defense, security, non-security, and do it in their way so they can send two aircraft carriers if they want to the Persian Gulf, that's possible. But do it in a sensible way, then it seems to me this shouldn't have a big impact on the economy. And it's basically what Washington should be getting to soon. And the thing about that kind of proposal, you know, we're not there yet. Instead, we're fighting over whether we should get taxes increased or sequester, a million other things rather than just delving into that. So that's my example now with respect to the current situation applying these principles. But if you could go on and do it with entitlement programs, do it with education programs, do it with the regulatory programs, and I think you come to the same kind of view. And that's what brings me to, I feel like, the optimistic thing. And quite frankly, I guess, since I feel to some extent I'm a little bit involved in this game, I'm arguing and testifying and going to Washington, and I served in the past, to some extent I'm involved in the game. So it's very hard to be pessimistic if you want to win and you're in a game. So I'm really not pessimistic. I'm optimistic. It seems to me the reason is if you think that what I'm saying is correct, and I urge you to look at the numbers and the data and the history and think about it, and I think it is correct, then it says the problem is policy, and the way to fix it is by changing policy. And that's the optimistic note I would want to end on. Change policy. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. John Taylor, Professor of Economics at Stanford University, the George P. Schultz Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of the new book, First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. If you were Ben Bernanke, what would you do now, given low interest rates? What would you do to move up interest rates and reduce the Fed balance sheet?
That's a good question. One of the problems I have with questions like that, though, is that it starts from where we are right now. And I would love to have had the question to be, what would you have done a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago? But I'll let that alone. I do remember, in my talk, remember I said that one of the reasons we got into this was a very low interest rate period in 2003, 4, and 5. I think we shouldn't have done that. It's one of these cases where it was well-intentioned, believe me. Get those rates low, get unemployment down, people buy more, you heard the story. But if that was a cause, it has led to astronomically high unemployment, not low unemployment. So that's, if you like, the heart of this. Then I would say going into the crisis, I think that there was a lot of fumbling around at the beginning, a lot of misdiagnosis about whether it was what I said or something else. So a correct diagnosis to see that the problem was in the banks early on, I think, would have been quite possible. I think during the panic, and I think this is very important to emphasize, during the panic in 2008, October, December 2008, there was some emergency operations. The Fed helped out the commercial paper market, money market mutual funds, which I think was productive. Quite frankly, it's a very difficult thing to make decisions in that kind of an environment, so I applaud them for those emergency operations. But then getting to the question, Evelyn, after that, I think the emergency really was over. That panic was over, and it was time to try to get back to the kind of normal monetary policy that worked and has worked so well in the past. So I wouldn't have done the quantitative easing, so to speak, which is the large-scale purchases of mortgage-backed securities and treasury bills. And believe me, it's large. One fiscal year, the Fed bought 77% of the debt issued by the federal government, and the fractions for long-term debt are similar to that now. And so I think it would have been better to cut the interest rates like they did. That was fine, but not to overdo it with all this extra, if you like, uncertainty that's been added. And I actually argue in Wall Street Journal, a recent article, it's counterproductive at this point. It's gone so far. And it's counterproductive for a number of reasons. One, all this has to be undone. It's so frequent the case where you do a short-run operation, you forget it has to be undone. And so it will have to be undone, and when it's undone, there's a risk of doing it too rapidly, which could be contractionary, could cut off this expansion. Or there's a risk of not going fast enough, in which case you'll cause inflation by the fact that so much liquidity, as we call it, is out there in the system. So then to finalize, what I would do now, and I think what I know from monetary policy is you never do something if you can help it suddenly. You try to lay out a strategy, lay out a plan. It would be to slowly lay out a strategy to begin undoing this. You can't do it overnight. You have to get support of other people at the central bank and other places, but lay it out and get started with it. And another reason to be somewhat optimistic that this something like this could occur, if we are fortunate to have a surprise increase in growth this year, then that may make the Fed more reluctant to continue with its purchases, which would get them off this, and I think that would be beneficial. So it'd kind of be, if you like, going away from a vicious circle to a more virtuous circle.
Thank you. You know, you talked about the sequestration and the debt ceiling. Do you advocate eliminating the debt ceiling?
Well, I think that's okay. This is a good question. The debt ceiling itself is a responsibility of the Congress. And maybe put it in this context. Long ago, it used to be that if the government wanted to borrow money for a project, it would have to get permission, an okay from the Congress. Okay, that sounds reasonable. A lot of states work that way now. At least maybe have to get a referendum for a bond issue. Was changed a long time ago so that the Congress gave this, if you like, delegated the authority over a certain amount of time up to a certain limit of borrowing to the administration. Okay, and that also made some sense. But what you'd like to have is a situation where whatever borrowing is approved is something that doesn't make the debt explode, so you don't continue to approve a higher and higher level of debt. Right? You want a way to approve a lower level of debt, at least as a share of GDP. And that, to do that, you have to get the debt limit decision, in sync with the spending and revenue decision. Because what has happened now and why this has been so confrontational is the Congress and the administration will agree on a spending program, agree on a tax program with a big deficit that raises the debt, and then lo and behold, the debt increases, and they have to come back and approve it. So the trick here seems to me would get in a mode where that you were raising the debt limit by an amount that corresponded to your spending and revenue decisions. And I think that would be a healthy situation. We're not there at this point in time. There's maybe a little bit of that happening because the most recent agreement was to raise the debt limit in May by the amount that spending exceeds revenues from now until May. So they're tied together to some extent, and I think that is a good way to proceed if we can stick with that. But in the meantime, the debt limit is, the confrontation over the debt limit, it would be far better to just go back to regular fiscal order, I'd say, where you have a president proposing a budget, the Senate and the House deliberating on it, and you come to a decision about what that amount of spending is.
Well, along those lines, there are some questions around new revenues that are needed to, in addition to the spending cuts. So could you talk about new revenue sources in terms of their economic desirability and prioritize them, if you will?
We already did have a revenue increase in the fiscal cliff agreement, raising top tax rates. In the percentages that I indicated, that represents about 0.3% of GDP. So go to those GDP numbers again, but I gave you some before, 0.3% of GDP. So It's in that sense, it's a spending problem, not a revenue problem. If you're thinking about closing a gap of 4% of GDP and you got 0.3 from this. So to me, people have to recognize, and it's not rhetorical, doesn't mean to anything except the facts, it is almost entirely a spending problem. And so you've got to focus on that. I don't think if you look at the numbers, there's much disagreement. I personally think that if you go to the recommendation I made a few minutes ago in my remarks, that we bring spending to where it was in 2007 as a share of GDP, you don't have to raise taxes anymore. We've basically done it. And I can tell you the reason for that. It's pretty simple. In the year 2007, we were approximately at a balanced budget. It was about 1% of GDP deficit, approximately balanced. What was spending then? 19.7% of GDP. Revenues are now projected, sorry to go all these numbers, revenues are now projected by the Congressional Budget Office in 2023, that's their span of time, to be 19.1% of GDP. So again, CBO projects revenues to be 19.1% of GDP in 2023. Therefore, if you simply bring spending to where it was in 2007, the budget would be balanced without any increase in taxes for all intents and purposes. Taxes will grow if the economy grows. You'll have more revenues to spend, but without increasing taxes in the sense of tax rates. There's also, I think, an important thing to note in this context, and this goes back to my experience in policy. We should have some kind of tax reform in this country. It's complicated. It doesn't help the job situation at all. It's still going to be a high tax on small businesses, the very high tax on corporations, incentive to ship jobs overseas, all those problems. So we need to have a tax reform. But the tax reform should involve, if it involves base broadening, which is eliminating loopholes and corporate loopholes, then there should be some tax rates that go with that. So I think, and this is kind of getting confused in the Washington battles, classically tax reform meant you broaden the base and you lower the rates. That's what happened in the 60s with President Kennedy's proposal. That's what happened in the 80s, late 80s, the bipartisan tax reform that occurred at that point in time. And that's what we should have now. So think about tax reform of this kind, where lower rates, expand the base. I think it would help the economy a lot.
Thank you. Some theory provides that the best explanation of the housing crisis was the, let me put it this way. Obama's interventionist policies haven't convinced conservative economists that things need to change, haven't convinced his own economists that things need to change. So a question I had asked you earlier, don't we have enough empirical evidence to know that the interventionist policies don't work? And so how do you then influence the current administration that they don't work?
It's one of the most difficult questions to answer. Why do economists disagree? I wish sometimes on these programs where they had two economists, they would force them to say, why do you disagree, rather than just repeating the same thing all the time. I think here, unfortunately, the questions about the overall economy, about stimulus packages and interventions, Keynesian interventions sometimes called, they're so difficult to analyze because the economy is so big. We have so many things going on all the time. It's hard to control for other factors. You know, it would have been worse otherwise. That argument. How do you confront? It would have been worse otherwise. Mm-hmm. Actually, I confront it a little bit this way sometimes. Just like common sense. A few years ago, my wife, she's in the first row, Lynn, gave me new golf clubs for my birthday. They were great clubs. It's gigantic driver. You couldn't help but get in a good drive with these clubs. So I was all excited. I'm going, it's going to be a real stimulus to my game. So I started playing with the clubs, and over a few times, a year or so, my game doesn't get any better at all. So I don't want to make her feel bad. Sorry, I'm going to admit to this to you now, honey. I don't want to make you feel bad, but I say, you know, my game would have been a lot worse if you didn't get me these clubs. It would have been a lot worse, you know. Of course, that's ridiculous. But in some sense, that's the kind of argument you have to confront. And we do this in economics by building models, and we do counterfactual simulations, and I do that a lot in my research. But there's going to be disagreement. I think on a kind of a more optimistic note from my perspective is during that span of time I mentioned to you, 70s, 80s, 90s, now, opinion did move. Professional opinion did move. Unfortunately, move back. So in the late 70s, when I was mentioning you had the Ford stimulus package and the Carter stimulus program for the states and various job programs and the Fed going bananas with ghost-top policy, economists doing the research kind of came to the conclusion, it was almost a consensus, that this wasn't working. And, you know, maybe they were influenced by the times a little bit, but their research said that. I mentioned the research we did for President Ford when I was working for him that said this policy didn't work. Well, a lot of the Carter administration economists, at least when they left, did analysis, and they showed it didn't work. The stimulus grants to the states, for example, the states just pocketed a lot of that money. And that's what happened in the last stimulus, by the way. It didn't really lead to many new construction projects. I've studied that very carefully. So we knew that before, but what my point here now, though, is we kind of learned, and those papers were written and digested, and that's one of the reasons policy changed. And we didn't do that for a long time. As I mentioned, it was kind of a bad word to do it. And so that reflects, I think, economists coming to agreement based on the facts. But it did take a while. Let's face it. It was a long time before policy got, I mentioned Nixon, really is stuff in the Johnson administration as well. It took a long time, maybe almost 15 years before it really changed. And so it takes time, and now we're sort of going through that again, I think. And I'm kind of optimistic that people do look at this carefully and do study it. They'll come to the conclusion that it basically wasn't very effective. To the extent it was effective, say the stimulus package or the cash for clunkers or the first-time home buyers or the temporary cut in the payroll tax, I could go a long list, of course. They will come to the conclusion, by and large, that they weren't very helpful. And at the minimum, they will conclude that they were temporary effects. They didn't get you this long, sustainable expansion. And in fact, as you're turning them off, you could say that's just part of the slow growth. So I think it will take time, but I'm optimistic. And you, as I said, I'm part of the discussion, so I have to be optimistic. But I think eventually the facts will be convincing. I'm reading a lot of books recently about policy in even much worse situations. And for example, Chinese policy under Mao, Soviet policy under Stalin, unbelievably egregious policies. And remember, people at the time were talking about them favorably. Fortunately, we got off of that, and people learned. You can learn from North and South Korea. I'm not saying that's what the comparison is here now. When I teach students, it used to be, you can see how old I am from just looking at me, but when I used to teach students years ago, I could talk about these crazy things the Soviet Union were doing in the economy. And since the Soviet Union is now beyond most students' memory banks, I don't have that anymore to talk about. So we didn't have more examples.
Talking about the aging population and the slow growth, does the change in our demographics, because the baby boomers are a much bigger part of the population, do they contribute to the current slow growth relative to other changes in the economy?
When we think about growth in the economy overall, GDP growth, there's roughly two parts of it. One is the labor force growth, how many people are working, because they're producing the product, the GDP, and the other is how much each worker is able to produce, and the latter is called productivity. Okay, so both factors are matter when you're projecting or analyzing long-term growth. And so if you have a slowdown in the population, and therefore a slowdown in the growth rate of the labor force, then you'll get, other things equal, slower long-term growth. The balancing factor is higher productivity growth, if you can get the higher productivity growth. And in some sense, the higher productivity growth is really all that matters, because that's what's going to affect people's incomes and wherewithal as much as anything else. So I would say there is longer term a lower growth rate because of a lower population growth. We don't know what's going to happen with respect to immigration and things like that, but generally speaking, but it's much, much smaller. Say then, the difference between 6% and 2% over the last few years, much different. So you can't really explain much of that discrepancy on that basis.
Okay. Trickle-down economics, does it work? And we hear a lot about the widening income distribution. So could you talk about, is that good, is that bad? How do you solve that widening income distribution?
Well, I'm definitely concerned about it, and it's definitely there in the data. There's, you know, people talk about the 1%. 1% has a much higher fraction of total income, total GDP, if you like, now than it had, say, in the 60s. There's data are hard to measure. You could mention all those things. It comes from the tax rolls, and people don't always report accurately. It doesn't include the fringe benefits. But when you even make those adjustments, there's definitely a spreading of the income distribution over time. Interestingly enough, a lot of that was in the 90s, and it in some sense it's halted. I'm not saying it's a good level, but it's halted because of the turbulence in recent years, because the very well off, their capital gains and other things declined. So just as a matter of again numbers, the percentage of income earned by the top 1% was 21.5% in 2000. It's now about 20%. So it's down. But that's because we've had this crisis, and it may go back again. It may start rising, and I don't know. But it's definitely gone up a lot in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Economists have all sorts of explanations. One is the greater rewards to education in our high-tech world, and that's corroborated to some extent by other countries, which have seen this as well. So if you don't have learn the skills, which you need to use the good technology, your wages are not going to rise, and they're not going to rise as rapidly as others, so that causes a dispersion. If you look at tax rates, some people argue it's the changes in taxes, but the truth is when you look at before and after taxes, these spreads are very much the same. In other words, the amount of redistribution that's in the system is about the same now as it was earlier when you take in all the loopholes and everything else into account. In terms of what to do about it, I think you've really got to understand it carefully, by the way, before we jump to conclusions. Some people argue it's because of the decline in the power of labor unions, for example. That's an argument that's made. But when you look at what labor unions do, it's not clear that they do anything but like spread the distribution, because they tend to get more for their members and less for others. So that's a spreading, if that's the truth. So you don't want to jump to conclusions. To me, the most important thing to do about this is deal with our education problem. And I'm not talking about college so much, otherwise I'd just look like another vested interest since I'm a college teacher. But I'm talking more about the K-12 and in particular the people in disadvantaged areas of our country, cities. And I just think it's a real, I didn't say much about it, but it's another tragedy, if you like, that we're not dealing with enough. It's just... It's a big reason for that spread in the income distribution. Not so much the top 1%, but really it's the lower end, which I think we should be very, very concerned about. And so education, that's another thing where I believe there's a lot more we could do in terms of applying those principles that I mentioned on the education front.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that, so I'll follow up that question. I just want to remind the audience you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Dr. John Taylor, noted Stanford University economist and Hoover Institution senior fellow, who is discussing how to rebuild America's economy. So, Dr. Taylor, how would you address the education issue from K through 12? I know there's a lot that are moving towards online technology for education. Is that going to help address it? And then how do you think about the lower income people and their ability to get access to education?
Well, I think the technology, the online, will definitely help. And here you have to have a way that these ideas are incorporated and adapted into the school systems. There's a, as in so many organizations, there's a tendency to resist change. And I, here I can speak on from experience in my university. There is a tendency to resist the new technology and to not use it as much. I think we're getting over that. In fact, Stanford is really out in front in many respects. But there's always a reluctance. And I think that's probably more of a reluctance at the K-12 area. The sense in which you're replacing a teacher with a program is not something that people take too easily. One little example of that, one of the courses that's being designed at Stanford, online course, been by a very excellent teacher, is being used at other campuses around the country. Just in the students, they have a faculty member who helps them, but their main lectures are from that. And so you can see how people be resistant, but you need, I think about that, and people are working towards it. And you want it to make it, you want to make the education better, right? It's not just cheaper. You want to make it better. And now in the K-12 area, some of my colleagues have been working on this a lot, and they feel that the one of the problems is just the delivery of the of education by the teachers. And they argue that if you could, you know, everyone is good at things and not so good at things, and there's a distribution of quality in my area, every other area. And Rick Heneshek, a colleague of mine at Stanford, argues if you could just take the worst 10% of teachers and replace them by the middle percentage, the ones in the middle, you'd get the best quality education in the world, basically, like Finland or something like that. It's hard to prove something like that, but there's a sense in which you can imagine if you could somehow make a change like that, it would be a lot better. So I think that's sort of the nitty-gritty of it. How you do that? Obviously, in any business, it's difficult to do that. And there's a lot of interests that are against it. I would say, to me, now I'm going back to my principles and thinking as an economist a lot, I think that the ability to choose alternatives helps a lot. And that's whether that's charter schools, which is making a lot of progress, or whether it's simply scholarships, sometimes a euphemism for vouchers. Whatever it happens to be, I think the more that can be done, we should be working at it. In the District of Columbia, it's a very popular program. It's oversubscribed, and it's helping minorities tremendously, and we can expand that. There's a big, in Louisiana, there's a lot going on. It's actually a lot of states and municipalities are moving in some kind of direction like this, encouraging more choice. And so that, and the advantage of choice, of course, is you want to make this open to the least advantaged. And if you only allow choice for the advantaged, the people who can afford to live in the good school districts, the people who have the money for private schools, you're accentuating that distribution problem. And it's just a terrible kind of policy. We shouldn't put up with it. That's one of those things that we should break the silence and deal with this. We have a good movie out there waiting for Superman, which I recommend you look at.
So how do you change the incentive system then so that the choices can be made for the lower income people that really don't today have a choice?
Well, you give them the option if they're school or district isn't performing up to reasonable standards on tests, and I've given many tests in my life. I know tests are not perfect, but they're a measure. Then you give them an option to go to another district even, or even to have some funds to go to the other district. So that's an incentive. And, you know, one of the real complaints about that is it's going to hurt the public schools. But, again, in my experience, that's not what happens. If you allow that, I mean, I don't think the existence of Stanford, since I'm here, has hurt Berkeley. I just don't think it doesn't really. You can have a mixture of private, and believe me, a lot of students at Stanford get publicly supported scholarships. You know, it's okay. So it's a good thing. President Obama wants more of it. So it's the way that gives you the choice. So I think there's a whole wide range of options. The incentives for the teachers is another incentive. And here, I would like to think that there's some kind of merit pay or rewards or something that could go on for good teaching, whatever it is, prizes or something like that. It just motivates people a little bit. So many other businesses have that. Teachers argue, how can you measure what my input really is? And that's true. How do you measure it? It's the outputs are sometimes many years later. I tell a story about that from my own teaching. It's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek story. Many years ago, Tiger Woods took my class as a sophomore at Stanford. I sometimes say he was the best student I've ever had. Why do you say that, Professor? Well, he learned about opportunity costs, dropped out of Stanford, and joined the Pro Tour. So, hard to take credit for that, but who knows?
That's great. In your book, you talked about healthcare and how the individual mandate violates one of your principles. So could you talk about how would you pay for mandatory health insurance or coverage if you don't have a individual mandate?
Yeah, the individual mandate, of course, involves the requirement that everybody buys this and buys a particular type of insurance. And so that's the concern I have. It doesn't allow for the choice that otherwise would exist. So it's, what you have to do is find an alternative way for everybody to get the care they need, if you like. And so here you have, going back to the idea of you have a certain amount of funds that can be used to purchase the insurance. If you are low income, you got a certain amount of funds that can be used to purchase the insurance program of your choice. If you want to spend a little less for a high deductible, or even a little less for just catastrophic, or you want to spend a little more for more services, you can do that. People in the healthcare area frequently object to that. You can't bring consumer choice to something so important. It's okay for, you know, vanilla chocolate ice cream, but it's not okay for healthcare. And so that we'll debate that for a long time. But I would say it's not so much that you're paying to buy, you know, this kind of a surgery versus that kind of a surgery, or you know, this treatment versus surgery. It's you're getting an insurance program, which then will allocate what kind of it's. And there's a lot that's already done already. Medicare Part D is that kind of a system where you get to choose what kind of insurance that you will get. So I think that would be much better. And some of the mandates, of course, there's mandates on employers too. And I think we're beginning to see some problems with that. The employers are, some are not expanding because they can't afford the insurance. Some are opting to just pay the penalty. So it remains to be seen. I hope we can at least find ways to improve on this. But again, it certainly is against the principles. And one other sort of illustration of that, if I may, there's a lot of debate about entitlement reform, right? Because their growth rate is exploding for say, Medicare. And it's growing much more rapidly than GDP, and everybody knows that. It's going to get worse before it gets better unless we improve it. Ironically, there's not, if you dig down deep, there's not that much different between the two sides that there is this problem, that we have to control the growth of Medicare spending. It's growing much more rapidly than GDP. They're really going to eat up the entire budget, that and the other entitlement programs. So there's not disagreement about that, and we got to control it, but there is disagreement about how you control it. And in a nutshell, I don't know where it'll play out. In a nutshell, one view is, okay, we're going to control this growth by having Washington decide what the prices will be, what the quantities will be, what the qualities will be. If growth is too rapid, we'll cut the price. If growth is too rapid, we'll cut the quantity. If growth is too rapid, we'll cut the quality. That may work, but that's the idea. The other approach is similar to what I was answering your question before. You allow people to have a certain amount of funds to get this kind of product or that kind of product, and you control the growth by making sure that amount goes over time at the right rate. So you get the same amount of growth in both cases. In the second case, individuals are making the choice about price, quantity, and quality within the overall budget, individually, based on their circumstances, where they live, who their doctors are, all their options. In the first case, it's being decided at the center. And as an economist, I prefer the latter to the former. And I think if people start to think about it, they may worry about individual choice and medical care is not like ice cream. But ultimately, I think they will come to a conclusion like that.
And it requires transparency to be able to do those
absolutely.
Choices.
Absolutely.
Right? Switching topics a little bit on immigration policy. With immigration reform in the news of late, what kind of immigration policy would you envision to be best for America, again, keeping your principles in mind?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Well, clearly we would need to have an immigration policy that allows immigrants, especially skilled immigrants, to come in and make America what it's always been based on people coming to our country, taking advantage of those principles, of it, like maintaining the principles. Let's make sure we don't lose the principles or people will stop coming. Actually, there's this joke we say that Mexico has been doing so much better, we're going to get a reverse migration to Mexico. Not quite there yet, but I hope Mexico gets better, but I hope we get better too. To me, you need to deal with the legal immigration and make sure that's working with H-1B visas and some kind of a guest worker type of approach. I think the emphasis on the skills are important. And so the biggest hurdles are the escaping the legal side and what you do with the people that are here. And they tend to be matched together. And a lot of it is this language, how do you care about it? Many people do not want to, if you like, sacrifice the rule of law. People have obeyed the law, people have not obeyed the law. But you recognize the fact that there are 11 million people here. And so I think the answer really is what Washington can get done, because we need to get it done, and what the compromise is has to balance those two things together. There's a lot of rhetoric that's put out between them, but I think if reasonable people can say, yeah, the border is an issue, the people here are an issue, we need to have reform on the legal side, it seems to me you could come to an answer. Actually, there's a lot of progress, I think. There's bipartisan presentations coming out of the Senate, I think, are a good start.
Okay. Let me turn back to China a little bit. So how does China keep its currency low? Do they do this by buying massive amounts of dollars? How are they doing that?
Yes. Yes. Okay. They basically have been doing that for a while. They want to maintain the currency so it doesn't appreciate so much. They buy dollars to support the dollar relative to their currency, make their currency lower in value compared to the dollar. They've been doing it for a while. It's one of the reasons they hold so much of our debt. Sometimes if you hear them complaining about holding so much of our debt, I would say, well, stop buying our debt, you know. When I actually worked for 4 years as the International Undersecretary at the Treasury when the Chinese were on a peg, and we did everything we could to get them off that peg. And the notion that we would ask them to buy more of our debt would be so far from any conversation I'd have. And that's one of, you know, by the way, one of the concerns you have about the growing debt now. You actually worry, if you're in Washington, people worry about the Chinese not buying a lot of our debt. And so if you imagine yourself in a negotiation on any issue, military issue or intellectual property issue with the Chinese, and the people on the other side of the table from you are your creditors, big time, it makes it a little harder to have a good conclusion on your side for the negotiation. So it's very important, I think, to try to resolve this problem. I think the Chinese are moving away gradually from this peg. Obviously, they moved off the peg. They're not literally have a peg anymore. They went on it a little bit during the crisis. So I think they are moving in the right direction. We have to encourage them more. But I say we also encourage them more on the things like the intellectual property, the things like the rule of law. We are seeing some interesting things in China now which relates to the income distribution. They are concerned about their income distribution. And as I look at their proposals, it's very interesting. I look at the proposals as actually trying to move a little more towards markets and less central. For example, one of the proposals of income distribution is to allow the firms to pay more dividends. And then the people who get the dividends will have more income compared to the people at the firm. Well, that's just what we would like, freedom to pay whatever dividends that you like. So there's a sense in which their efforts, if we, I think, continue to maintain our principles, will be beneficial for the world economy. But if they move towards more centralization, more controls, it will be a problem. In the United States, our country, the United States, has provided, I think, an enormous benefit to the world over many years. After World War II, we encouraged trade. We encouraged rules-based trade through the general agreements on trade and tariffs, encouraged a lot of integration, helped set up the IMF and the World Bank, and by the 1980s, strongly encouraged China, Deng Xiaoping, to move away from that central planning. The way we were there all the time, and it's been an amazing accomplishment. You know, hundreds of millions of people brought out of poverty by them moving towards markets, towards those principles. Quite frankly, that's what they moved towards. Those principles, not all the way, got a long way to go. And so what we need to do in America is another reason, I think, to focus on these principles. If we don't stand up and be like the leaders more generally on this economic, in these economic areas, I don't see anyone else doing it. The Europeans are not about to. And I think that's not what the Chinese are ready to do either. So it's another reason to help, not only help us, but help us by helping more globally changing these policies.
And what do you think is the perception of the rest of the world, if you will, towards America, given our huge debt and our huge the issues that we have? Can we play that leadership role or continue to play that leadership role?
It's hard. I think a slow growth economy is hard to lead the world, and you're seeing a lot of ideological complaining with Asia, especially, I think, in China. The Europeans, as I mentioned a while ago, you could feel good we're not that bad, I suppose, but that's not the way I would put it. I think that if you think about, talk to people around the world, a lot of people grumble about the U.S. and its power, but the truth is they frequently depend on aspects of that. So let's think about dealing with that in a constructive way, whether it's through monetary policy or fiscal policy. And here, people are trying to do the right thing. If we don't maintain our leadership and be positive about the contributions, and I'm talking about the economics here. Security is a whole other long discussion, but they are related. I think that people will benefit from that, and we will benefit. And now we're by no means there yet. Our country is strong, and our principles are good, and people are still want to move here, and people talk positively, but it's slipping, and we need to be careful about that.
Okay, unfortunately, we're at the time of the program where there's only time for one last question. So this is a little prognosis on your part. What do you see as the future of the two-party system? Can our financial challenges be addressed within the system as it currently exists, or is there something else?
Yeah, I think the two-party system is with us for a while. It's been with us for a long time. And sometimes we've had these movements away. It hasn't helped that much. But your question really is, we seem to have this extraordinary partisanship, right, with the two parties, and people are looking for another party, another way. And I think the reason for that is these are really important issues, and there are big disagreements about it. There's a disagreement about this size of government. You would hear another speaker say things quite differently, well-meaning, than I am saying right now. And so we have these differences of opinion. In a democracy, we have, in the United States at least, the two-party way to deal with it, and it means that you're choosing a party which basically has most of the things you like, and that's not going to have all the things you like, that's for sure, and you can either exit to go to another party, or you can, of course, you don't have to be in either party. You can just vote for where you want, but you can vote towards another party if you don't like the other one. But it seems to me that the system of working within each party to change it is important. I have, in addition to the things you mentioned, Evelyn, at the beginning about working in government, I've also spent a lot of time working in campaigns, in political campaigns. And I found that's an important way to contribute to our democracy. You always think about going to Sacramento or going to Washington, but there's the stuff getting there. And a lot of decisions are made there by candidates, and they have to follow through with the bulk of them. And so it's a real time to get involved and do more of that. And so I guess the bottom line is this can work. This system could work, but you have to participate and you have to get involved. And so I urge you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. John Taylor, Professor of Economics at Stanford University, the George P. Schultz Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of the new book, First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We want to remind everyone here that copies of Dr. Taylor's book are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them in this room following the program. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.